all money is God's money, and He has given it in certain places where it's being held to steward.
Using God's money to enable vocations. A newly released report illustrates a major impediment to those seeking to join the priesthood or enter religious life. A Catholic organization is taking action to tear down that wall. Why action is needed to help foreign-born priests remain in their parishes in the United States. Family prayers are answered when a major prisoner swap is announced between the U.S., its allies, and Russia. Wrongly detained Americans head home after being held in Russian prisons for years. And his father was one of the most admired journalists in America. We talk to Luke Russert about how his Catholic faith sustained him at his deepest moments of grief. EWTN News in Depth starts now.
In the last 5 years, there's over $3 million that have been absorbed by the religious institutions and dioceses just to deal with the issue of student loan debt. $3 million, that's a lot of money.
Religious institutions and dioceses are spending big dollars to help pay off the student loan debts of their priests and religious. That's according to a new first-of-its-kind report exclusively reported by EWTN News. The Center for Applied Research in the Apostolate at Georgetown University, or CARA, conducted the survey, which was commissioned by the Laboré Society. It surveyed religious institutions and Catholic dioceses across the U.S. to find out the impact of educational debt on religious and priestly vocations. That impact is profound. I'm Catherine Hadro. Welcome to EWTN News in Depth. Institutes report they are sometimes forced to turn away serious inquiries or ask those interested to delay their application due to educational debt, a serious issue considering the dwindling number of priests in America. As Monse Alvarado reports, many seeking a vocation are turning to the Laboré Society for help to pay their debt and follow their spiritual calling.
I could tell you the moment that I knew I was going to be a priest. So I was serving Mass here in fourth grade or fifth grade, wherever I was. And we knelt at the side of the altar for the Eucharistic prayer. And at the moment the priest elevated the Blessed Sacrament, I just had this strong feeling, that's going to be me one day.
During my third year of medical school, I had a couple of life-changing encounters with Jesus in the Adoration Chapel, in which I heard him loud and clear calling me to become a priest.
Called to the priesthood. The journey can be difficult in today's secular society, but one of the greatest roadblocks many face...
I had student loan debt.
I have all this debt.
Some dioceses that have a financial limit for debt allow priests to pay off debts with their stipend. The more fiscally challenged the diocese, the lower the debt threshold amount and the lower the stipend. But most dioceses won't take on a candidate for the seminary if they have significant financial debt. That means that men seeking to become priests are forced to wait for years.
So for me, probably around 10 years from now, because I haven't been able to join the seminary yet. I'm conditionally accepted by the Archdiocese of Denver, so I need to mitigate my student loan debt before I can enter the seminary.
And it's not just priests.
I'm seeking to join the Servants of the Lord and the Virgin of Mata, probably like 7 to 9 years from now, God willing, the process.
All religious institutions per canon law require a candidate to be debt-free before they can move forward with formation. Jake Smith, who hopes to become a priest, and Marie Arnold, seeking to take religious vows, aren't alone. According to the CARA report, of the 275 religious institutions and 83 diocesan vocation directors who responded and took part in the survey, some 80% of dioceses have applicants with student loan debt. As well as 70% of religious institutions, only 10% of those religious institutions have the ability to absorb the debt so aspirants can enter formation. In hopes of cutting down that wait time, Smith and Arnold are now working with the Laboré Society to learn how to pay off their loans.
We deal with individuals that have over $100,000 or more.
John Flanagan, the executive director of the Laboray Society, explains the program brings together about 20 to 25 aspirants who work together as a class over a period of 6 months. They collectively raise funds for a common pool. At the end of each class, all the funds raised are awarded out on a merit basis, helping the entire class reach their goal.
We've helped over 400 enter into formation.
During the process, aspirants reach out to friends, family, associates, and strangers to share their vocation story and ask for them to become benefactors to help mitigate their debt.
So that very first ask, I was really, really nervous.
The interaction isn't easy, especially for those who are called to serve, to ask for financial help.
It was definitely nerve-wracking, but we, with the Laboray Society, we get a lot of practice in how to do it.
But it's more than simply asking for money. They also ask for prayers. They learn about a benefactor's story, form relationships with them, pray for them, and learn the art of gratitude. These relationships can become lifelong. Throughout the 6 months, aspirants are paired with an accountability partner to journey alongside them.
Accountability partners are just... they are a gift during this process. She's like another rock that is like helping me and supporting me along this way and along this journey.
We talk once a week, and during these weekly meetings, we talk about how things have been going, the highs and the lows of fundraising. If I'm running into some kind of an obstacle, he's a really good sounding board, and he's really knowledgeable and experienced.
An accountability partner can be a layperson who has some expertise in business or finance. It can also be an alumni of the program who has walked in their shoes. Father Scott Barkey, ordained a little more than 2 years ago, is a graduate of Laboray.
I took five six-month classes, so 2.5 years.
Now as an alumni, he assists in being an accountability partner.
I experience those ups and downs, and so, you know, when they're up, I can encourage them and keep them going. When they're down, you know, and they certainly need encouragement at that point, right?
The skills he says he learned are lifelong.
You know, as a parish priest, your air conditioning is going to break or your roof is going to leak and you need to fix it. Whether you want to or not, you're going to have to raise money. And whether you like it or not, you're going to have to be able to raise money.
The fruits of the program, however, are so much more than financial stewardship.
As I believe so strongly that it was a very, very important part of my formation as a priest.
Board members tell us that the process helps aspirants in their discernment and leads to a higher retention rate of finishing a vocation.
So between 7 and 8 out of 10 stay the course. They go on to final vows or ordination or are currently in process thereof. The typical seminary retention rate is about 50%. So there is something about doing this process that deepens the discernment.
A young man or woman, or a man or woman who has disciplined themselves, devoted themselves to the Laboray process, is typically a healthier, more mature, holier vocation.
At the end of the day, these aspirants aren't pursuing their vocation for themselves, but for the sake of the church.
As time has gone on, I'm really starting to realize that God pays for what he orders. The money is out there, and I am going to be able to enter formation as soon as God wants me to.
Montse Alvarado, EWTN News, in depth.
Now for more discussion and analysis of the report and the impact of student debt on vocations, we are joined by the Laboray Society's Executive Director, John Flanagan, and Laboray Board Member and alumna, Sister Josephine Garrett. Thank you both for being here, and thank you both for your work. John, I want to go to you first. What was the greatest key insight you gained from this CARIS study? I mean, what is the impact of educational debt on vocations to religious life in the priesthood?
That the debt issue is not going away, and it's growing. 70% of religious institutions are currently facing this issue, 80% of dioceses. And the dollar amounts that we see as an institution continue to rise for the elements that we're helping. The average debt that the Laboray aspirant is being able to mitigate through Laboray is now north of $100,000, well over the national average.
Sister Josephine, you serve on the board of the Laboray Society, but as I mentioned, you are also an alumna who has benefited from it. Do you mind sharing how much of an impediment was your student debt to you fully embracing your vocation as a religious sister, and how did you overcome that?
You know, when you ask that question, I think of the practical, the physical impediment, like the dollar amount. And I also think of the spiritual impediment, too. You know, the various things that could come up. It was interesting for me because I had a good job. And when I entered community, I didn't leave that job right away. And so I thought I would use the surplus income from not having bills, living in the convent, still working to pay off that balance I had left, which was about $40,000. But my community, they really taught me humility. They were like, or you could go and see about this resource laboratory. And so the physical impediment, yeah, it was about $40,000. But there were so many other spiritual impediments that came with that, that laboratory was able to enter into as well. Being, yes, a solution for mitigating student loan debt, but also in so many more ways, a solution to contribute to the formation of future priests and religious.
I can only imagine the anxiety that comes with that debt during that part of your journey. John, something I'm interested in asking is, does a woman with debt entering into religious life face more roadblocks than a man with debt who's becoming a diocesan priest, for example? How does that experience typically compare overall between religious sisters and our priests?
Well, diocesan priests typically get a stipend. So there's often a threshold of debt allowed for them to move forward. But for those seeking to enter religious life as a female, there's not typically any kind of stipend. So it's a much larger roadblock. In fact, it can be just a brick wall. But the fun side of it is some of those that have gone through our program, the most successful have been even those who wanted to join a cloister, where you may think of them as being introverted. They're not going to let anything stop them from being able to answer God's call. Mm. So it's a wonderful way to watch him excel.
Absolutely. Well, speaking of being introverted versus extroverted, Sister, the Laboratory model is based on a multidimensional relationship-based fundraising model for people pursuing vocation. So this might be the first time that these men and women are having to fundraise for themselves. Can you speak about that aspect of this? Because I imagine that might be uncomfortable for some at first.
It's absolutely uncomfortable, but look, we know that, you know, saints aren't made in comfort and vocations shouldn't be formed in comfort either. So what we're all called to is not about comfort. And so, you know, John, as I was listening to what John just said about the difference between introverts and extroverts, and yes, this is a challenge for both extroverts and introverts to go out and ask for help, to fundraise, which is an area where we often have a lot of bias. But I think it's actually life-giving to introverts because these are not surface-level conversations. They're not small talk. What participants in the Laboratory ministry find themselves in are conversations that are conversations about the things that matter most to us. So when we go to fundraise, we don't just ask for money. We share our story. We share what God is doing in our lives, what we have seen, what we have heard, what we have looked upon, what we have touched. And then we invite the person that we're sitting with, who we are asking for financial support, to share their story with us. And I think those are conversations that introverts tend to be most interested in, which is why I think is one of the reasons we see so much success, even from future women who are called to the cloister, because what they're finding themselves in are the most life-giving conversations for a person, whether you're introverted or extroverted. So this is a relationship-based approach to ministry. It's not just about fundraising. It's about building the kingdom, allowing people to give witness to what God is doing in their life, whether they're called to religious life or not. It's about sharing stories. And it's beautiful to see that people who thought they couldn't do it absolutely can do it when it's for something like the gospel.
That's such a great insight because it's so vulnerable, but again, about the most important thing. John, does the reality of student debt that we're discussing, does it disproportionately affect our church's ability to welcome in religious who come from lower levels of income? And are we missing out on priests and religious who come from marginalized communities because of this?
I have to think yes. When you start to look at the data from the study, those that are the mission diocese, those that need external support to just do their daily bread, those dioceses tend to have a threshold that is much higher for be able to accept and candidates come in. So they're allowing people with $50,000, $60,000 moving forward. That's hard to do on a $15,000 annual stipend. So you have individuals where they have less money, so they allow more in or try to absorb more of it as a religious institution. They can't. I mean, one study showed that 60% of religious communities don't have their retirement funded. Is it a question of robbing Peter to pay Paul, caring for those you have, or allowing somebody new to come in? So yes, it does make an impact.
Mm. On a practical note then, Sister Josephine, what's your advice to a young person who feels a potential calling to religious life and is wary of entering into higher education for this exact fear of procuring debt? Should someone avoid taking on student loans or going to college if they're discerning a possibility of a vocation to religious life?
I wouldn't say to avoid going to college. I wouldn't say that. I would say to be mindful in your discernment. If you're already aware of a possible call before entering to college, to just be mindful and discerning and a good steward regarding acquiring student loan debt. But I wouldn't say to people, don't go educate yourselves. Because, and John can speak to it, we do have a model that we're going to be rolling out that looks at diocesans' efforts to educate their seminarians and getting ahead of that and helping to fundraise for that. So I wouldn't say don't be educated. I wouldn't say don't educate yourself, but be mindful about acquiring debt, be discerning about acquiring debt, which is something we should always do. But I also want to speak to folks who may come from marginalized backgrounds or lower income settings and just speak to some of the mindset that can be in place when that's our experience and our background. I think one of the things that we have to work on in marginalized communities is helping to foster hope. Mm. I think sometimes what we see for ourselves as possible when we come from those communities is not as much as is actually possible. And so I do want to encourage folks who are coming from marginalized or lower income communities that, and then maybe taking on more debt because that's your circumstance, that this is all God's money. And if God has called you, he has in store for you a solution to the money problem. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, this has been illuminating. John, Sister Josephine, thank you both for this discussion.
Thank you.
Student debt is just one of many potential obstacles facing vocations for people who are trying to follow God's plan for themselves. That report is next on EWTN News In Depth.
If we lost all of our international priests today, we would be in a lot of trouble.
As the number of priests in America dwindle, a call to action to convince Congress to help missionary priests remain in the U.S.
I will never leave the church because at my lowest moment, it was there for me in the most important way.
And my interview with author Luke Russert. We talk about the Catholic faith that sustained him after the shocking loss of his father, a devout Catholic and one of the most respected journalists in America. EWTN News In Depth is coming right back.
We continue our conversation now about challenges to vocations. We've talked about student loan debt, but with more and more Catholic dioceses in the U.S. relying on foreign-born priests to fulfill their needs in their parishes, we now look at potential stumbling blocks unique to them. They're called work visas and green cards. Reporter Roselle Regis explains.
I am Father Carlos Rivero. I'm originally from Colombia, South America.
Father Carlos Rivero left his hometown to enter seminary in the United States, following his heart and answering the call to priesthood. He was eventually ordained a priest and incarnated into the Diocese of Savannah in June of 2020.
Now I am in one of the biggest communities or parishes of our Diocese of Savannah. It's a community of Sacred Heart in a little town called Warner Robins.
Father Rivera was welcomed into Sacred Heart Catholic Church in 2022, and he expected to live out his vocation in the Diocese of Savannah. However, with an unexpected procedural change in how green cards are processed for foreign-born religious workers, he will be forced to leave the country next year.
Yeah, that really took me by surprise, and I can know, I worry about that sometimes. What's going to happen with my community here?
To welcome a priest from another country, the diocese must file for one of two visas, the temporary religious worker visa, or R1, or the special immigrant religious worker visa, EB4. If they seek permanent residency in the United States, they would have to get an EB4 visa. Until April of last year, the path to a green card was straightforward and seamless. However, the U.S. State Department recently revealed that for years it had been placing in the wrong line tens of thousands of applications for neglected or abused minors from Guatemala, Honduras, and El Salvador, and would now start adding those to the general queue with the clergy. According to the USCCB, there are now about 155,000 people in line for an EB4 visa, creating a severe and sudden backlog.
A priest applying for a green card today will be forced to wait an estimated 15 years before a resident visa becomes available to him.
Bishop Mark Seitz from the Diocese of El Paso, who also serves as chairman on the Committee of Migration for the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, addressed this issue at the Spring Assembly held in June.
This means that the same priest would need to come on three separate R1 visas with at least 1 year in between under current regulations before receiving his green card. This is simply not sustainable for our ministries, and it is especially devastating for parishes that will be left without a pastor.
Echoing Bishop Seitz, Father Rivero says a year away from his parish community is too long.
I'm going to be able to keep working with these processes, you know, that I have with some parishioners, you know, some spiritual direction, some people that I'm helping and working with them because they're getting sacraments, because they're planning to be married the next year, for the summer next year. I don't even know if I'll be here next summer.
Father Rivero is only one of many foreign-born religious workers in the United States facing this dilemma. On the West Coast, the Archdiocese of San Francisco is set to lose five priests in the next couple of years.
The challenge is to continue to meet the pastoral needs of a very dynamic archdiocese.
Father Tom Martin is the associate vicar for clergy for the archdiocese. While he worked with many seminarians, the abrupt change in visa rules has also affected him directly. Father Tom, who also serves as pastor for St. Pius Church in Redwood City, California, says he recently lost a good priest who was doing great things in his parish.
It's impacted us, you know, in ways that we couldn't have anticipated. So in an area where we have a growing number of Spanish-speaking Catholics, having someone like Father Edgardo just really helps to meet an incredible need.
These past 3 years have been a great blessing for me and my priesthood.
Father Edgardo is now living in El Salvador, waiting for the year-long wait to pass until he can apply for another R1 visa and hopefully return to St. Pius.
You will be deeply missed. You will always be a member of our family. You will always have a home.
To figure out exactly how many religious workers will be impacted in the near future, the USCCB conducted a recent survey, which revealed that about 70% of U.S. dioceses employ workers on a temporary R1 visa. Almost 30% of dioceses have had at least one R1 visa holder forced to depart in the past 12 months. Looking ahead to the next 12 months, more than 50% of dioceses expect one or more of their workers to be forced to depart.
This confirms what we thought to be the case, which is that this is an increasingly prevalent issue that dioceses are facing. And unfortunately, it's only going to worsen with time.
David Spicer is the Assistant Director of Policy for Migration and Refugee Services at the USCCB. He explains that the USCCB is actively working on solutions.
The USCCB has been very engaged on this issue, and we've met with the White House, the Department of State, the Department of Homeland Security, as well as many congressional offices to bring this situation to their attention.
Spicer said their primary recommendation is to shorten the one-year period between R1 visas.
We're just hoping that it will be a 30-day time frame, which then is much more manageable for dioceses and other organizations that are relying on foreign-born religious workers. And what we've requested of Congress is to exempt out the vulnerable children who are currently relying on this same allocation of visas as foreign-born religious workers, and to treat those children as the humanitarian class of immigrants that they are.
While the USCCB continues to advocate for foreign-born workers with no immediate resolution in sight, Bishop Seitz reminds us Catholics what the heart of the matter is when it comes to immigration.
What higher form of Christian charity is there than hospitality freely given to those in need, motivated only by the recognition of their God-given dignity?
Rosal Rages, EWTN News in Depth.
We will continue to follow this issue to see if there are developments in this tangled visa policy for religious workers. Next, top headlines in This Week in Review.
Can't imagine their joy right now. They're home.
A major feat of diplomacy involving years of negotiations and multiple partners, as the U.S. and several allies swab at least 24 people in the biggest prisoner exchange since the height of the Cold War. Fears of an all-out war increase in the Middle East after Israeli strikes in Lebanon and Iran kill 2 key Hamas and Hezbollah leaders.
Even if you walk away with a medal, that next day it can also be very challenging.
And we talk to Catholic missionaries ministering to the athletes in the Olympic Village in Paris.
I spent a lot of time with the families of Evan and Paul and Alsu. And most of the time, as you can imagine, those are tough conversations. But not today. Today, excuse me. Today was a very good day.
After years of detainment in Russia, 3 Americans and a prominent Russian dissident who resides in the U.S. are free. They were part of a complex and sweeping prisoner exchange that took place in Turkey. On Thursday night, the 3 Americans arrived safely back to the United States and were reunited with their families. This prisoner swap, the largest between the United States and Russia since the Cold War, tops The Week in Review. With 24 prisoners exchanged, it was a multinational deal years in the making. President Joe Biden called it a feat of diplomacy.
This is an incredible relief for all the family members gathered here. It's a relief to the friends and colleagues all across the country who've been praying for this day for a long time. The deal that made this possible was a feat of diplomacy and friendship. So for anyone who questions whether allies matter, they do. They matter.
The Americans released are Evan Gershkovich, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, who was wrongfully detained for more than a year on conspiracy charges. Former Marine and businessman Paul Whelan also returned home after more than 5 years in Russian detention. And Alsu Kremasheva, a dual citizen Russian-American radio journalist, detained in 2023 while visiting her ailing mother. Among others released are several prominent Russian dissidents, perhaps the most well-known Russian-born journalist and opposition leader Vladimir Karamurza. A contributing columnist for The Washington Post and legal resident of the U.S., he was arrested when he returned to Russia in 2022 and charged with treason for speaking out against the war in Ukraine. Karamurza continued to write opinion pieces critical of Vladimir Putin from behind bars in Russia and won a Pulitzer Prize for commentary earlier this year. Dissidents released to Germany include several top lieutenants of now-deceased Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. The long negotiations had included the proposed release of Navalny as part of the prisoner swap before his untimely and suspicious death in a Siberian prison last February. Those who know about the negotiations say Navalny's release was central to the plan, and negotiators had to start from scratch when he died. At the Moscow airport, President Putin personally welcomed the 8 Russian prisoners obtained in the swap, a group of spies and hackers. Among them, the prisoner Putin was reportedly most interested in, Kremlin-linked assassin Vadim Krasikov. He was convicted and imprisoned in Germany for murdering a Putin enemy in 2019 in broad daylight, shooting the victim from behind at point-blank range in a Berlin park. Putin has repeatedly fought for Krasikov's return from Germany, which had long been reluctant to give him up. And a late-night airport welcome Thursday in the United States, when President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris greeted the Americans upon their arrival at Joint Base Andrews in Maryland. Their elated families also on the tarmac to greet their loved ones with relief at their safe homecoming. In comments to the many reporters there, President Biden said there is no way this prisoner return could have happened without strong alliances with the other allies who agreed to and participated in the complicated prisoner swap. Tensions are high in the Middle East after two back-to-back Israeli strikes in Iran and Lebanon assassinated high-profile leaders. Analysts say the attacks could lead to an all-out war in the region. The strikes come just days after what Israel describes as the deadliest attack against it since October. A Hezbollah rocket crashed into the Israel-controlled Golan Heights on Saturday evening, killing 12 children who were playing on a soccer field. In retaliation, Israel launched a strike in a densely populated area of Beirut on Tuesday. The attack killed Hezbollah military commander Fuad Shukr, who Israel claims was responsible for the rocket attack in Golan Heights, though the Lebanese militant group denies these claims. While Hezbollah and Israel have exchanged almost daily strikes for the past 10 months as the war in Gaza continues, many see these attacks as major escalations in the proxy war. Less than 12 hours later, another deadly strike in Tehran killed Hamas political leader Ismail Haniyeh. The prominent figure was attacked at a highly secured guest house on a day of heightened security for Iran's presidential inauguration. Though not a military figure, Haniyeh managed international relations for Hamas and was involved in ceasefire talks. Both Iran and Hamas promised to retaliate against Israel. Former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Simone Ledeen says the assassination sends a clear message to Iran.
This was a message to Iran saying we can get whoever we want, wherever we want. Nobody is safe. Iran has been ratcheting up the pressure since on Israel through its proxies in Yemen, in Lebanon. And now Israel has taken very decisive action, not just in Gaza, but as we've seen in the region. To let everybody know, and especially Iran, we are prepared to address all of these threats.
This strike would be the most overt action Israel has taken against its rival since it hit Iran's embassy in Damascus this spring. Israeli forces also announced on Thursday it killed Mohammed Deif in an attack 3 weeks ago. He served as commander of Hamas's military wing. Widespread and deadly protests marked Venezuela's presidential election this week after socialist incumbent Nicolas Maduro declared victory on Sunday night. The president's announced win has been marred by numerous allegations of fraud by both the nation's opposition party and a growing list of global leaders, including the United States, which said in a statement that Maduro's loss is clear. In response, Maduro has asked the Venezuelan Supreme Court to run an audit on the vote. But opposition leaders worry the high court's close ties to the president will impact its results. If Maduro's win stands, he will serve another six-year term as president, a role he's held since 2013. Though his popularity has dwindled as a result of Venezuela's economic crisis, mass migration, and deteriorating relations with the West. These international high-stakes situations, several full-blown crises, are playing out as U.S. voters decide who will become America's next president. The biggest headline for former President Donald Trump this week involved his appearance at the annual meeting of the National Association of Black Journalists on Wednesday, in which he answered some tough questions with a question of his own. Injecting race into the campaign, he asked whether Vice President Harris was really black or whether she was Indian, suggesting she was leaning on her black heritage now for political expediency. Speaking later that day, Harris chose not to directly respond, instead calling the remark divisive and disrespectful. She said the American people deserve better. In the meantime, on Thursday, delegates to the Democratic National Convention began online voting for the party's nominee. Within 1 day, Friday, she had officially secured the nomination. Harris is expected to name her vice presidential running mate before launching a tour of seven battleground states next Tuesday. An issue we know will be a focal point in the election, abortion. This week, Iowa's pro-life law went into effect after overcoming legal challenges at the state Supreme Court last month. The law protects life at 6 weeks of gestation, around the time a heartbeat can be detected. Iowa is now the 22nd state to protect unborn life after the overturn of Roe v. Wade in 2022.
So what we need to do is vote, because I'm going to tell you something. When I am president of the United States, I will sign into law the protections for reproductive freedom. So let's get this done.
Vice President Harris decried the Iowa law in a new video, calling it a, quote, Trump abortion ban. This week, her campaign launched what it called a fight for reproductive freedom effort, which included numerous events in battleground states. Acting head of the Secret Service, Ronald Rowe, answered questions from lawmakers on Capitol Hill this week about the assassination attempt of Donald Trump. He expressed shame that neither local nor Secret Service personnel were watching the roof where a gunman fired shots at the former president.
Why was the assailant not seen? When we were told that building was going to be covered, that there had been a face-to-face that afternoon, that our team leads met. This was the view. These were discussions that were had between the Pittsburgh field office, the local counterparts, and everyone supporting that visit that day. And that's why when I laid in that position, I could not, and I will not, and I cannot understand why there was not better coverage, or at least somebody looking at that roofline when that's where they were posted.
It was the most detailed account yet of the shooting that left one attendee dead and others injured on July 13th. Rowe testified that local law enforcement who spotted the gunman on the unmanned roof before the shooting failed to communicate the threat to his agency. He told lawmakers about numerous steps the Secret Service has taken to enhance protection since the attempt, including expanded use of drones and improved communication with local law enforcement. Rowe struck a more forceful tone than his predecessor, Kimberly Cheadle, who resigned last week after a similar hearing. But he still faces pressure from lawmakers to fire those responsible for the security failure. This week, President Biden announced proposals for term limits and ethics codes for U.S. Supreme Court justices. He presented the proposals in Austin, Texas on Monday, saying they aim to combat extremism and the public's waning confidence in the high court.
In recent years, extreme opinions that the Supreme Court has handed down have undermined long-established civil rights principles and protections. My fellow Americans, based on all my experience, I'm certain we need these reforms. We need these reforms to restore trust in the courts, preserve the system of checks and balances that are vital to our democracy.
Biden proposed 18-year term limits for the justices, with a new justice appointed every 2 years. He also called for a new code of ethics, requiring judges to disclose major gifts, refrain from political activity, and recuse themselves from cases when they or their spouse have a conflict of interest. And he once again asked Congress to reverse the Supreme Court's landmark ruling on presidential immunity. These reforms face an uphill battle in a deeply divided Congress and are not likely to be approved anytime before Biden is out of office. Controversy continued at the Olympic Games this week following the opening ceremony that appeared to disrespect a sacred event in religious history. But that is not dampening the Christian zeal and ministry happening behind the scenes at the Games. Reporter Mark Irons explains.
Each passing day of the Olympics offers someone recognition, a chance to be in the spotlight.
Well, if God wants to be glorified at an event on this scale, why would we as Christians not think the enemy is going to be trying to stir the pot and trying to put himself also in the spotlight?
For many Christians, the start of the 2024 Paris Games brought anger and frustration and an abundance of attention, headlines, and reaction. After faith was seemingly mocked in the opening ceremony when Da Vinci's Last Supper scene with Christ surrounded by his apostles appeared to be replicated with a drag queen fashion show. But if the spotlight only remains on that, Emily Frelick, a Christian and 2024 Olympian rowing for Team USA, says the greater truth won't have room to shine.
We're being deceived. You know, like, it's easy to be deceived to think like Christ isn't also being glorified in this grand way.
As an athlete, Frelick is here to compete at the highest level, but that's not her main mission. Years ago, when she thought she might be done rowing after college, she felt God had other plans and was calling her to the Paris Games.
there's no other event like the Olympics where every nation or all these nations gather at one time. And I just sensed God saying, like, he wants to be glorified at this event. And he wants people to go to this event and represent Christ. Maybe it doesn't look like God's being glorified, but lives are being touched. There's so many ministries.
Emily isn't the only one who sees the hand of God at work here.
We've been able to be in the presence of current and past Olympians or people involved with the sport, and just to evangelize.
Father Joe Fitzgerald, a Catholic priest from New York, was sent to Paris on behalf of the U.S. bishops to observe and see how faith could play a part when the 2028 Summer Olympics take place in Los Angeles. Simultaneously, as these 2024 games go on, the Archdiocese of Paris is hosting what it calls the Holy Games, offering the international crowds throughout the city a chance to connect with faith through sport, visit local parishes, receive the sacraments, and serve others. Father Drew told us about one Holy Games event hosted after Mass.
And they opened the doors, and the homeless of Paris come in, and we're feeding them. We're doing like this coffee and like croissants and this music and dancing. So it kind of tied in with like prayer. And then like a little bit of like, we're going to feed them and then we're going to have a little bit of fun.
The international Christian group Youth with a Mission is also in Paris working to make God known to others. Meanwhile, inside Olympic Village where athletes stay, Catholic missionaries are walking among them.
It matters because all these athletes have eternal souls.
Kelly Hartman works with Focus. The group sends Catholic missionaries to serve on college campuses. Through its Varsity Catholic program, missionaries like Kelly are focused on bringing Christ to athletes.
The college experience is very different for a collegiate athlete.
A former college volleyball player herself, Kelly knows the busy schedule of an athlete, so she can relate and help others as they develop a relationship with Christ. At the Olympics, Kelly and her fellow Varsity Catholic missionaries want the competitors to know their true worth.
We've had the chance to speak with a handful of athletes who haven't, you know, who are done competing and they didn't do as well as they'd hoped. And so to be able to speak the truth into their life that they are a beloved son, they're a beloved daughter, and that their identity and their worth doesn't come from their athletic achievements.
Even for those who win the medals, without a firm foundation in Christ, questions about identity can come after they step off that podium. And Emily Freilich knows some athletes who are already dreading the end of the Olympics.
I've talked to several teammates who are non-believers, and they're already saying, like, I'm really scared for the post-Olympic depression. When we go home, you lose all your teammates, you lose your coaches, you lose your daily schedule. What is my purpose in life? And I think those are the big questions people start asking.
That was the experience of this athlete who competed in the 1996 Olympics in Atlanta as a member of the U.S. men's handball team. After the games, before he was known as Father, Joe Fitzgerald encountered the same issues.
And I didn't have something like what was next. I didn't know what to do. And I struggled. I struggled with my identity. And if you don't know that your identity is based not on your performance, but that you're a beloved son or daughter of God, then you can spiral into some real dark places.
Which is why he says it's been a blessing to be in Paris, around the athletes and out in the city to share the gospel.
Jesus went to the well. Jesus went to the pool at Siloam. He didn't go just into the synagogue.
To continue to lead these people to Jesus.
Emily has had the chance to share her faith publicly and pray with others. At the Olympics, she's not just representing Team USA.
I feel God saying, no, I want to be represented. I want people who are there for Jesus and to proclaim my name. And so I was like, I want to be a part of this, Lord.
Mark Irons, EWTN News In Depth.
We will continue to have observations from a Catholic perspective from the Olympics in the weeks ahead. Next, a very special interview.
When I was there in the church and I was there with the priests, it was, we've been here before, we'll be here again, it's okay, you know, you're in our hands now, we'll take it from here.
Leaning on faith in an intense moment of grief, the faith journey of Luke Russert, when we return.
To accept faith, we have to resign ourselves as mortals to the fact that we are just a small part of a grand design. Well, my dad may have been a small part of God's grand design, but he was such a big presence here on this earth.
That was a young Luke Russert back in 2008, honoring his father, Tim Russert, at his memorial service held at Washington, D.C.'s Kennedy Center. Russert was a broadcast icon and political journalist as the longtime host of NBC's Meet the Press, who died suddenly of a heart attack at age 58. During his life, Tim Russert was open about his Catholic faith and upbringing, a faith he left to his only child, Luke. And in the 16 years since his father's death, Luke Russert has been on a professional, personal, and faith journey all his own. He followed in his father's footsteps to become an Emmy Award-winning political journalist for NBC News before setting off on a three-year journey across six continents to better discover his identity and to finally confront the pain of losing his father. It's all documented in his book, Look For Me There, Grieving My Father, Finding Myself, where he opens up about how he leaned on his Catholic faith amid his mourning. In a sit-down interview, Luke also tells me how prayer was a lifeline for him in the raw moments immediately following his father's sudden death. This is Luke Russert's Faith Journey in Depth. Luke Russert, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Luke, I've always felt a kinship with you from afar because both of our fathers went to John Carroll University.
Oh, go Blue Streaks.
Yes. A Jesuit university in the suburbs of Cleveland. They both also died suddenly from heart attacks.
Yeah.
And in your book, Look For Me There, Grieving My Father, Finding Myself, you unpack your grief and largely through traveling the world in this three-year odyssey across multiple continents. And early on in your book, you address your father's unexpected passing. You were in Europe with your mom.
Yeah.
Your father was in Washington, D.C. And when you and your mom got that tragic news from overseas, you write, quote, "Now is the time to rely on our Catholic faith. We hold hands and pray a Hail Mary." Luke, why was that your immediate instinct?
You know, one thing we do in the Catholic Church very well is we're prepared for death. We're prepared for that next step when we leave this earth. And I think it's so interesting. People talk now a lot about, you know, wellness and meditation. And I've always said the best example of that is the Catholic Church and the teachings we've had for so long. Mm-hmm. And I think in that moment, when you experience that type of tragedy, when your entire world is rocked to its core, the rug is pulled out from underneath you, to use a metaphor, mm-hmm. you're looking for something that's stable. You're looking for something that can guide you in the right direction. And for that, that was our faith. The single belief that, you know, you're so fortunate for the time you had with that loved one, but pray and they're in a better place and they're looking out for you, and ultimately they're at the place where we all want to be. And I think we came to that place, and also just such a community in the church, mm-hmm. Which I think is so needed now more than ever. You know, we see community fraying around the country, whether you're left or right. People are desperate for more of a sense of community. And the Catholic community really comes through in times of crisis, for personal times of crisis. The amount of people who reached out to us, the amount of priests and nuns who offered us their prayers, it was so incredibly helpful, and I'm so grateful for that. And that's why I always say I will never leave the church, because at my lowest moment, it was there for me in the most important way.
Mm. I was struck by the fact that your last family trip together and your last family photo was at the Vatican.
Yeah.
And then your father passed 2 days later. I mean, can you speak about how your father's Catholic faith shaped him and who he was?
It was really everything. You know, he was someone who was deeply involved in the faith from a young age. He went to St. Bonaventure in Buffalo, and that's where he was named editor of the student newspaper by Sister Lucille, and that was sort of his first foray into journalism. Mm. And, you know, when I started to research the book, my own book, I was going through a lot of my father's files, and I did not know that he was deeply involved in the CYO. And he was actually their elected president in Buffalo, and he played CYO basketball. And I knew he was a member of the CYO, but I had no idea to the level that he had risen up through the ranks, and he had gone to D.C. as one of their, you know, exalted ambassadors and whatnot. And he actually told me a story that when he was in high school, he went to Canisius High School in Buffalo, mm-hmm. and he had to work to pay for his tuition. One of the things he would do is work in the rectory. And one of the jobs that he had in the rectory, a lot of it was cleaning dishes or, you know, mopping floors. But one of them is that you would have to sit at the door and be the sort of barrier between whoever was in the neighborhood and wanted to talk to a priest. So, you know, someone's knocking on the door, I want to talk to Father. Okay, well, what do you want to talk to him about? Mm-hmm. And my father said to me, that was the best political education I ever got, was manning the door at the local parish, being the buffer between the congregants wanting to talk to the priests, because I would learn so much about people's problems, where they were in life, what they were seeking out, what they needed, where they felt lonely, where they felt whole, etc. Mm-hmm. And I think that is something that was very special to him. And that always, you know, he always stayed loyal to the church. The story that we always tell, you know, my mom, when she had me, I was a big baby. I was 9 pounds, 13 ounces. And they had to do a cesarean section. And those are sort of complicated. And my father went to the chapel near the hospital in New York where I was born. And he made a pledge to the Virgin Mary that if I was born healthy, he would never miss Mass for the rest of his life. And he honored that pledge, which is, when you think about all the travel he had to do, how busy he was.
Especially on Sundays.
Especially on Sundays. He was a big fan of that Saturday vigil.
I can imagine.
But it speaks. I think it speaks volumes. And he always honored that commitment, and he passed it on to me, and yeah, I'm so grateful for it.
That's really beautiful. You, in your book, you openly grapple with your identity and your purpose and living up to expectations and legacy that comes with having two prominent parents, Tim Russer and journalist Maureen Orth. If it's not too personal, Luke, I'd be interested in hearing in your prayer journey how you have come to find your identity and your purpose, not so much as an earthly son, but as a son of the Father.
That's really a good, it's a good question. I think we all sort of struggle with that existential question, right? Who are we? Why are we here? What is our purpose? And in the Catholic faith, your purpose is something that is very much explored. I think from a young age, we're always taught that we're men and women for others. What are you doing here on this earth just to not take up space, but actually giving back or moving something forward in a positive way? And I think for me, especially born into great privilege, which privilege my parents did not have, I was the first member of my family to have it, that was a real question I sort of grappled with, which was, why me, God? Why am I given all these things, things that my parents had to work for so hard, some things that other people do not have at all? I'm conscious of that. Why me? And why do I have to shoulder that journey? Could it be easier not to have this? Could it be easier to not lose my father, et cetera? You ask these questions. But what I was very blessed by is over the course of a lot of meditation, of a lot of prayer, was getting to a place of that you yourself are equipped for this. There's a reason why you are here. There's a reason why you were put in these situations. And there's a reason why you can be helpful to the world. And it all came together for me, actually, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I write about it in my book, Praying in the Tomb of Christ, asking this question, why me, why me? And they said, no, he heard you. Just you go forward and you be perceptive of things. And that was something that I think I had missed up to that point, was that I was not as perceptive of things as I could have been. And that is where I really felt the power of prayer, and I felt the power of our Lord, was this idea that you don't necessarily have to have it all figured out right away, but you need to be aware. You need to feel that grace. You need to feel that faith formation and be aware. And if you're aware, the rest takes care of itself.
Luke, what role does gratitude have in your life today when it comes to, frankly, combating resentment and in processing grief?
I think it's so important to be a glass half full person. We're very fortunate just to be born. I always tell people that's you're already one step ahead that you were born. Then I think when you think, especially the United States, you're afforded the freedoms that we have here, to be grateful for that. Mm-hmm. But I also think in the context of loss, it's very easy to become angry. It's very easy to become bitter. It's very easy to have grievance towards your faith or others. You know, why me? Why do I have to go through this? But when you take a step back and you think about, okay, even in my darkest times, I am so blessed. Even in my darkest times, I can find that light. It's very powerful. And that's a force that I think can really carry people. And I think, unfortunately, now we live in a society where everybody is a critic, where you have an entire industry based upon reviews and how I feel. And it's at some point you just got to go, you know, people are trying their best. And give them the benefit of the doubt and look for the things in life that make you happy and look for the things in life that ultimately say, you know, we're all in this together and let's go forward in peace.
to love and serve.
Luke Russer, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
There is much more to my conversation with Luke Russer, including how he strives to live up to his namesake, St. Luke, and his take on some top current events. You can watch the full interview on the EWTN YouTube page. We'll be back in a moment. Finally today, a joyous pilgrimage for 50,000 young people who visited the Vatican this week. The International Association for Altar Boys and Girls brought servers from more than 20 European countries to Rome. The highlight of their week of activities, an audience with Pope Francis in celebration of their ministry. EWTN's Vatican Bureau shares the altar servers' experience in our Images of the Week. I'm Catherine Hadro. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you again same time next week for another edition of EWTN News in Depth. Until then, God bless.